Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Rachel Wright, and in the early hours of Friday, the 28th of June, these are our main stories. Joe Biden and Donald Trump are preparing for the first televised debate of their latest US presidential race. US Supreme Court judges have rejected a multi-billion dollar bankruptcy deal linked to the country's opioid epidemic. Kenya's High Court has upheld a decision to deploy the military to quell mass demonstrations in which more than 20 people have been killed. Also in this podcast...
The International Space Station is a state-of-the-art microgravity laboratory that is unlocking discoveries not possible on Earth and helping us...
But it's also very old. So what will NASA do with it? We begin in the United States, and as we record this podcast, final preparations are in place in the city of Atlanta, where the two main contenders for this year's presidential election will compete in a TV debate. It will be the first time a sitting US president has held a debate with his predecessor, and also the first face-to-face meeting between Joe Biden and Donald Trump in 4 years. If their previous encounters are anything to go by, then this CNN debate in Atlanta will not be pretty. The BBC's Katrina Perry is in the city and explains the complexity of the television debating format.
It's going to be very different. Can't overstate that, really. They're used to what they did in 2020 with an audience, but also they both came through primary debates that time round as well, where there were other candidates and live audiences, and that's what they're used to. They haven't done any debating at all since then. Now they're going to be in a studio with two moderators. It'll be a far more intense environment as well, because there won't be those kind of pauses that the whooping and hollering that an audience gives to you allows, and you have to wait for it all to die down and so on. And the moderators will be able to push back with follow-ups if they want. The way it's going to work is, time-wise, for each answer, the candidates will be given 2 minutes, and there will be lights that will tick down on their screen in front of them and on the camera, so they'll know that their mic is about to be muted. At the end of that 2 minutes, the opposite number will have 1 minute to rebut. And again, the same tick-tocking light system will be visible to them, and they'll know they're about to be muted. And then at the moderator's discretion, there can be an additional 1 minute if they want to follow up or push back. So that could allow for a bit more of an intense engagement. They won't be able to shout over each other. Well, I rephrase, they will be able to both shout at the same time, but all of us watching won't be able to hear the other person. CNN have been demonstrating this themselves on their network all day with two correspondents standing at each podium and showing what happens.
The US presidential election itself is still months away, and polls suggest they are neck and neck. So both men will be looking to steal a lead in a campaign that has been overshadowed by the Republican Donald Trump's numerous legal woes, including a recent felony conviction and concerns about Joe Biden's age. Our North America editor, Sarah Smith, reports on the build-up to the TV confrontation between two deeply unpopular candidates.
Keep yapping, man.
The people understand you. Use the word smart with me. Don't ever use that word.
Oh, give me a...
The radical question. Left.
Will you shut up, man?
American voters have heard all this before. The rematch between the two oldest candidates in history leaves them cold, with most people saying they do not like the choice they're being offered.
I am outside Lincoln Field Stadium in Philadelphia. The Rolling Stones are about to go on stage, surrounded by people who are drinking beer, eating sandwiches and crisps, just having a great time before the gig. Soon Mick Jagger will be strutting his stuff. He is now 80 years old, about a year younger than Joe Biden. So do his fans think there's no problem with the president's age?
I think we just do need some new candidates, some young.
Chris and Bridget Giacos live in Pennsylvania. They're entertaining friends, serving drinks from the boot of their car, as I ask them about President Biden's age.
Nobody talks about his policies or what he's doing. They just talk about the fact that he's walking around confused half the time. That's why they call him Sleepy Joe. He's too old.
And yet you're about to go and see Mick Jagger. He's practically the same age as Joe Biden.
He's not leading my country.
Whoa. I will say this, Mick Jagger's a president.
Bridget's mum, Carol Davis, says she thinks Joe Biden is too old now, let alone the age he'd be at the end of a second term.
But Donald Trump's only 4 years younger. If you look at the two, there's no comparison. Donald Trump may be as old, but he doesn't act as old, he doesn't act as feeble. It's just different, I think.
Older voters are far more sympathetic. John Laird first saw the Rolling Stones in 1982. This will be his 15th gig, and he sees the value in experience.
His agility is not a 27-year-old kid.
He's not
a senior citizen, but he is smart. He knows what he's doing. He's experienced. I've got confidence in him so far.
Do you worry that Joe Biden will lose a lot of votes from people who think he is too old?
Yeah, that is a concern.
We'd all like to be able to move like Jagger.
The Trump campaign are trying to weaponize Joe Biden's age against him, flooding social media with video that makes him look old and infirm. Like the TV pictures of him seeming to wander off confused when he was meant to be posing for a photograph with other G7 leaders in Italy earlier this month. The Biden campaign complained these images have been taken unfairly out of context.
There's a shark 10 yards away from the boat.
Donald Trump still says some very bizarre things in his rambling speeches. This was a recent rally in Nevada.
The boat is sinking. Do I stay on top of the boat and get electrocuted? Or do I jump over by the shark and not get electrocuted?
Democrats clip up and circulate these soundbites trying to cast doubt on Trump's mental acuity.
Like I did. I took a cognitive test and I aced it. Doc Ronnie Johnson, does everyone know?
It was
Ronnie
Doc Ronnie Jackson who gave him that cognitive test.
We see Donald Trump for who he is. He's been convicted of 34 felonies.
The Biden campaign are hoping that voters who were prepared to consider voting for Donald Trump will now be repelled by his criminal conviction. So far, becoming the first ever former president to be found guilty of a felony has had relatively little impact on Donald Trump's poll ratings. John McHenry is vice president of polling company North Star Opinion Research.
For some of the independents, it might make a little bit of a difference. They didn't necessarily learn anything new about him, but it may say, I'm not happy with the economy, but I'm not comfortable with voting for a felon. Maybe just around the margins that matters, but it's a close race, so that margin might actually come to play come November.
It is a big day here in Atlanta. Tens of thousands of people will be watching the U.S. football team playing Panama here, as well as those who are tuning in for the debate. A debate that will be the pivotal moment of the campaign so far and could set the tone for the rest of the race.
Sarah Smith. The US Supreme Court has blocked a bankruptcy deal that would have shielded the wealthy Sackler family from being sued for their role in fueling America's opioid epidemic. Under the agreement, the owners of Purdue Pharma would have been given immunity in exchange for paying billions of dollars to combat the health crisis. Here's Neda Taufik.
5 out of the 9 justices sided with the Biden administration in objecting to the agreement. They decided it was a misuse of the bankruptcy system to free a third party, the company's owners, the Sacklers, from future liability without the consent of those with claims. The decision now puts into jeopardy a long-negotiated settlement in which the Sacklers had agreed to give up to $6 billion to states and local governments and tribes and individuals to address the public health crisis.
Neda Taufik. The High Court in Kenya has upheld a decision to deploy the military to assist the police in dealing with mass protests that have shaken the country for several days. The Bar Association had argued that sending the military onto the streets was unconstitutional. Kenya's president, William Ruto, may have hoped that by scrapping his controversial finance bill, that would have put an end to street protests. But once again, demonstrators came out on Thursday in several cities, though in fewer numbers than earlier in the week, and there were skirmishes with the police. From Nairobi, our Africa correspondent, Barbara Plett-Usher, reports.
Police fired tear gas at small groups of protesters in the city centre, breaking them up before they could gather. This was nothing like the mass demonstration on Tuesday when a flood of protesters took over the streets and breached the barriers around Parliament. This time the army was deployed. There was more security and it was better organized. The young people leading the movement are also divided on whether to continue the demonstrations after President Ruto ceded to their demand to drop the tax bill. Some are ready to take up his offer of dialogue, but many are suspicious. Like Phoebe Apondi.
I don't think the
president is being very honest with everyone, but I'm trying not to underestimate him, because even though he says that he's trying to talk to us, his actions don't match his words. He said he will not sign the bill, but that doesn't mean that he's not going to take advantage of us. And also the fact that he doesn't acknowledge that people have died. He doesn't acknowledge how many people are hurt. He's very heartless.
Others were here in memory of those killed in the protests. A few were wearing white and holding candles. There is a lot of anger. Many of the protesters are calling for Mr. Ruto to step down and say they won't stop until he does. But for now, the president's moves have calmed the dangerous tensions building earlier this week.
Barbara Plett-Usher in Kenya. For months, the UN Children Agency, UNICEF, has been highlighting the plight of Palestinian children caught up in the Gaza war. According to the latest estimate by the Hamas-run Ministry of Health, 14,000 children have reportedly been killed and thousands more injured or displaced. Now, a group of 21 children with cancer have crossed the border into Egypt and have been taken to the UAE for urgent medical treatment. The UN spokesperson, Stefan Dujarric, welcomed the move but said more help was needed.
In a war zone where people cannot escape, you can very well imagine that there are a huge number of people who need medical help, whether it's through chronic disease and they needed dialysis, or whether it's from wounds sustained, from amputation. There are a lot of people who need help. Very few have been fortunate enough to be evacuated compared to what is likely a very big number. But, you know, the Rafah crossing remains closed for intents and purposes, so it's a very challenging situation.
Meanwhile, Israel has mounted an operation against Hamas fighters in the Shajaya district and have told Palestinians to leave the area. Emergency services in Gaza say at least 7 people have been killed so far, and there are fears that more people may be buried beneath the rubble. Our Middle East analyst, Sebastian Usher, reports from Jerusalem.
Residents in the Shajaya neighbourhood in Gaza City say that there was the sound of tanks approaching and firing in the early afternoon after overnight bombing. The Israeli army issued an order for people in the area to evacuate and head south down the main highway in Gaza. That route was taken in the early weeks of the war by hundreds of thousands of Palestinians seeking safety, as Gaza City was the first focus of Israel's offensive against Hamas. Once again, men, women and children carrying food and bags are making that journey. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said the intense phase of Israel's war against Hamas is now nearing its end, but the ability of Palestinian fighters to regroup in areas of Gaza from which they were driven out months ago means the conflict is likely to continue for the foreseeable future. One resident in Shajaya said the deafening sound of bombing made it feel as if a war was restarting.
Sebastian Usher. Next to space.
The International Space Station is a state-of-the-art microgravity laboratory that is unlocking discoveries not possible on Earth and helping us push farther into deep space.
Every single day, we are answering big questions about Earth and about space, about where we came from and about where we're going.
A video by NASA there promoting the International Space Station. It currently circles the Earth every 90 minutes at an altitude just above 400 kilometres, with a speed of 28,000 kilometres an hour. But, like most things, it's ageing. So what do you do with it? Well, you can either leave it to crash down on its own and just pray it doesn't hit anyone, or you can try and guide it down with another so-called tugboat-type spacecraft and ensure it goes somewhere safe. NASA has decided to engage Elon Musk's SpaceX company to help. Our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos, told me more about it.
The first elements of the space station were put up in 1998, and we've been living in space permanently since 2000. Now, that's quite a while now, isn't it? It's 24 years. And like everything, it's eventually going to have problems.
Getting a bit rusty.
You can repair bits, you can exchange components, but the central core, they can't do much about that. And it's going to have an end of life. And so they're having to prepare for that day. And currently, the partners on the space station, so that's the United States, NASA, European Space Agency, the Canadian Space Agency, and the Japanese Space Agency, with Russia, they've kind of agreed to keep running the space station until the end of the decade. And then they're looking to get out and do different things. And the question is, what do you do with the space station when you get to that point? They can't just leave it circling the Earth, because eventually it'll fall into the atmosphere. And it's big. It's, you know, it's 430 tons. It's the size of a football pitch. That's going to cause quite a bit of damage unless they do it in a better, safer, more calculated way.
So currently, if they left it, it could land anywhere.
Could land anywhere.
But so that's why they've given it to Elon Musk, I assume. And so why have they given it to him? And what's he going to do?
So they're giving him a contract of about $800 million to build a spacecraft, if you like, a tugboat. And they will allow the space station to gradually come down to decay its orbit over time as it sort of brushes through the top of the atmosphere. When it gets to the point where it's about to plunge into the atmosphere, they will then use this spacecraft to guide it, to push it to a specific location. It's called Point Nemo. It's in a really remote part of the Pacific Ocean. It's about 2,500 kilometres from any land. And those parts that do survive will crash into the ocean and will go to the sea floor, never to be seen again.
What if this is likely to replace it then? What's going to happen instead?
Well, the hope is that by the time of this fireworks display in the sky, because it will be spectacular, they will hope by that stage there will be commercial space stations up there. So there's a number of industrial consortia now that are looking at building and launching individual space stations. They'll be run on a commercial basis, so, you know, individuals can purchase a hotel stay, if we can call it that. That will be the future. And then the big space agencies, they're going to go off and build a space station around the moon. So it's a shift in focus.
And will you be buying a ticket, Jonathan?
I don't know. If there's a few space stations up there, there'll be a bit of competition. There may be lots of different rockets, capsules. Maybe the ticket prices will come down.
Our science correspondent and space enthusiast, Jonathan Amos. Still to come.
My guess was number one is human, number two is AI.
I also concluded, to the point where I was prepared to put money on, number one being human and number two being computer generated.
How much of a threat to education and coursework is artificial intelligence, or AI? Three days ago, Ukraine began formal membership talks with the European Union. On Thursday, it got another big boost by signing a long-term agreement with the EU, designed to help it defend itself against the Russian invasion. The security pact was signed off at a summit of EU leaders in Brussels that was attended by Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. Member states are also discussed how best to use proceeds from frozen Russian assets to help Ukraine. Addressing the 27-member bloc, Mr. Zelensky thanked them for their ongoing support.
I'm grateful for the decision that provide Ukraine with the financial resources from frozen Russian assets. It's fair that the assets of the terrorist state work to protect Ukraine suffering from Russian terror, and we must find the right way to confiscate all these assets.
Our correspondent at that summit in Brussels, Bethany Bell, told me more about what's been agreed.
It's a deal that potentially could go up to 10 years. It's a commitment by the EU to help Ukraine in 9 areas of security and defence policy, and that includes things like arms deliveries, it includes military training, defence industry cooperation and demining. This whole support for Ukraine is really part of a broader effort by Ukraine's allies here in Europe to provide assurances that they will stand by Kyiv for the long haul. They didn't give a detail of just how much they'll be giving Ukraine, but they were really trying to send signals of support at a time which is potentially quite complicated, because the revolving presidency of the European Council is about to change to Hungary. And there is a reminder that Hungary is still blocking 6.6 billion euros in military aid for Ukraine. But today there was a sense of solidarity.
Bethany Bell. The US President Joe Biden has pardoned thousands of US veterans convicted under now repealed anti-gay laws. The pardon applies to those who were convicted of engaging in gay sex between 1951 and 2013. The White House says the move will impact about 2,000 former service members. Those pardoned could now begin receiving benefits for which their convictions made them ineligible, but they will not be compensated for benefits they've already missed out on. And some aren't hopeful this will work in their favour, like Mona Maguire and Carla Lehman, who were discharged in the late 80s when their relationship was discovered. Carla is in the state of Michigan and Mona is in Milwaukee. Victoria Uwankunda first spoke to Mona.
I think it's a good step going forward. It's a small step. We still have to apply for a pardon, and you still have to be reviewed by the board, and they still have to approve the pardon. So it's not a final done deal, but it is a tiny step forward.
What about you, Carla?
Yeah, I agree with Mona. I feel like it's a great step, but there are still a lot of hoops to jump through. And for Mona and I, we're not sure if we're going to qualify or not. Our circumstances are a little bit different. We weren't convicted of a crime. We pled to the crime. We admitted that we were gay. And as such, we took a discharge. So we weren't actually convicted. We opted not to go to court. And so we don't know if this pardon applies to us. We're just not sure, and neither is our attorney.
And so that takes us now into hearing your story, how the decriminalization of same-sex relationships affected you. If I may just speak from you, Carla.
It was hard when we first got out of the military. Was the whole effect of having to explain to your family what had happened. I didn't know I was gay when I joined the military. And so not only now did I have to out myself, but I also had to explain why I was coming home and why I really failed in my military career. And so that was really difficult. And then when we first started applying for jobs, when we got back home, I struggled. The first job I applied for with a law enforcement agency, I scored top of the list, but they passed me over initially to wait for a ruling from the Department of Justice as to whether or not I had been convicted of a crime or not. Ultimately, that agency didn't hire me. I got into a different agency. There were times of just complete humiliation when you get interviewed for those jobs. They talk about your military discharge, and you have to lay out what happened to you and why. And it just was really humiliating at times, and a struggle to talk to my family about, especially my grandfather, who had been military and really wasn't understanding what was happening.
What about you, Mona? How was it being kicked out of the army, being discharged?
Very similar. Definitely humiliating, embarrassing. At our discharge station, once the paperwork was final, they said, okay, bye-bye, you're on your own, go home. We had really no money to go home. I mean, we're 19, 20 years old. We're trying to struggle. Do we take a bus? Do we take a plane? And then again, when I got home, I had not really spoken to my family while I was in Germany. Just the opportunity wasn't there. So the one or two times I had spoken to my family, they thought everything was great because everything was great in the beginning. And then all of a sudden I show up on the front door knocking, hey, mom, let me in. They're confused. Why are you here? You were in Germany. What's going on? And now we're having to tell an embarrassing, humiliating story.
Do you think the military culture has changed since both of you served, if I may start with you, Carla?
It's hard because I'm a little detached from it in the sense of the day-to-day operations and such. If I have to judge based on what we're going through right now, I kind of have to say no. It hasn't changed for us. Now, people who are active duty may be living a different experience post don't ask, don't tell. But for me, it's kind of the same as it was when I left. I can't get this discharge upgraded, and it's really, really frustrating.
What about you, Mona?
I absolutely agree. I'm detached from it as well. So, you know, I don't know a whole lot of what goes on in today's military, but if you just overhear people talking in the office, it doesn't sound like it has changed much for females serving in the military.
Mona Maguire, and before her, Carla Lehman. The International Union for Conservation of Nature has added the world's smallest elephant to its list of endangered species. It says there are now fewer than 1,000 Bornean elephants in the wild because nearly all of their habitats on the island of Borneo have been lost to deforestation. It's hoped the warning will boost efforts to conserve the animals, as our environment correspondent Helen Briggs has been finding out.
The sound of elephants crunching over the forest floor on the island of Borneo. These animals are special in many ways, from their diminutive size, roughly 8 to 9 feet tall, to their playful nature and baby faces. But numbers are in decline as forests are chopped down to make way for palm oil, timber and other crops, destroying much of their natural habitat and bringing them into conflict with humans. Now the elephants being classed as endangered on the red list, which conservationists hope will draw attention to its plight. Professor Adrian Lister of the Natural History Museum in London is among researchers studying the unique genetic heritage of the elephants.
We hope that by getting the Borneo elephants onto the red list, that will galvanise the efforts for their conservation to protect their habitat, because the authorities will now see that the eyes of the world are on this species.
Experts say the best hope for the long-term survival of the elephants is to create and maintain wildlife corridors in the forests, allowing them to roam freely without straying into human areas in search of food.
Helen Briggs. Most people are proud of their hometown or city, but it appears that some are better than others, at least according to the Global Livability Index, which has published its annual list of most livable cities. And yet again, the Austrian capital Vienna has come out on top, and Damascus in Syria came bottom. The survey measured a number of factors that determine how easy life is in 173 cities around the world. Harry Bly has been looking at the leaderboard.
For each city, the Economist Intelligence Unit assesses 30 indicators that are divided into five categories. Stability, looking at the prevalence of crime, the terror threat, and civil unrest. Healthcare and education, the availability and quality of both. Culture and environment, which examines how comfortable the climate is, the level of corruption, censorship, food and drink, and how available goods and services are. And infrastructure, looking at housing, the quality of roads, public transport, water, energy, and telecommunications. Ratings are compiled and weighted, and the city is given a score out of 100. Western Europe as a whole was the best performing region, with an average of 92 points, though this is down on last year's average, thought to be due to a drop in stability from an increase in the number of disruptive protests across several countries. At the top of the list, Vienna, which received top marks for four out of the five categories. It's the most livable city, and not for the first time. It's taken the title for the past 2 years, as well as from 2018 to 2020. The biggest change compared to last year was Tel Aviv in Israel, which dropped 20 places to 112. In last place was Damascus, deemed the least livable city following years of civil war and residual instability.
Harry Bly. Now, how much of a threat to education and, crucially, the assessment of students with exams and coursework is artificial intelligence, or AI? Well, that was the question in the minds of researchers at the University of Reading here in the UK when they set about comparing the work of real students with that generated by AI. They found exam essays written using AI consistently scored higher than those written by mere humans. Rebecca Kesby spoke to the co-author of the study, Associate Professor Peter Scarfe. So how much better did AI do?
100% AI written answers gained higher grades. The advantage was around half a classification boundary on average.
I thought there was a way of detecting these AI submissions.
Detection is a really complicated matter, actually. So OpenAI, who produced ChatGPT, which is the AI we used in the study, they actually released a detection software, but then removed it because it wasn't good enough, basically. It's making too many errors. So I think the kind of detection route is not going to be the way forward.
Do you have any idea of the extent to how many essays that are submitted are done using AI?
No, not at Reading, obviously. We can make a few inferences. There was a report from, I think it was the University of Glasgow, who in a short period of time had recorded, I believe it was around 100,000 kind of logins and access to ChatGPT on campus.
And as an educator, how concerning is it that so many students are looking for assistance from artificial intelligence?
Yeah, it is obviously concerning for the academic integrity of assessments. However, this isn't the first time the education sector has had to adapt to a kind of big change. You know, when the pocket calculator came on the scene, I imagine people were scratching their heads thinking it was the end to mathematics exams. Our assessments will just have to change in the face of this new technology and indeed embrace it.
OK, so we have staged our own bit of research here at NewsHour.
Yes.
And one of my very clever colleagues, our producer Alex, has nobly put forward the conclusion of an essay he wrote back in 2010. And he put the essay question through ChatGPT to come up with an essay. I've read the conclusion, so have you, of both the AI-generated one and the original essay as written by my colleague. We don't know which is which.
No, we don't.
We don't, but we're going to guess now which one was which. It was a history question, and it was based on Tudor history. Do you think it was the real human was number one or number two?
My guess was number one is human, number two is AI.
I also concluded, to the point where I was prepared to put money on, number one being human and number two being computer generated. You've put it through AI as well.
Yes, it disagrees with both of us, actually. AI said that the second one was AI generated, and it was pretty confident. It said it was 75% confident.
Just because we wanted to be absolutely accurate with our own research here, we've enlisted the help of an independent adjudicator. This is Susie. She's a university lecturer at Queen's University, Belfast, and this is her conclusion.
In my opinion, essay one is student written and essay two is AI generated. Essay one offers a level of personal reflection and insight. Essay two is more formulaic, relying on perfunctory lists. And essay one also demonstrates some kind of minor grammatical errors, and it could be more concise in parts, which I would associate with genuine undergraduate student writing.
You see, that's exactly what I thought. Thank you, Susie, from Queen's University for that. I did think number two was to the point, you know, but lacking extra details and a bit bland. I do have the answer here in a folded envelope. I'm opening the envelope. The human essay is essay one.
Oh, cool.
So all of us humans that read it were correct, and the AI computer was wrong.
Reassuring.
Peter Scar from the University of Reading in southern England. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Callum McLean. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Rachel Wright. Until next time, goodbye.